Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We're spending the hour this week with Dr. Bernard Lafayette. He is chairman of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and has been a giant of the civil rights movement, working alongside Dr. Martin Luther King, John Lewis, and many other icons. He was a co-founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960, and in 1968, he became the national coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign that was founded by Martin Luther King. Dr. Lafayette visited Vermont recently as part of the 50th anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign, which is being marked by a new display about the campaign that has been put up at the Ben & Jerry's factory in Waterbury, which is Vermont's largest tourist attraction. The display is from the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture and will be available to see for all visitors all year long. Dr. Lafayette, what was the Poor People's Campaign?
The Poor People's Campaign was a major campaign planned by Martin Luther King to put a face on poverty. Many times people talk about poverty and impoverished conditions, and they talk about people, but they use statistics. But Martin Luther King thought it was important that the poor people themselves would face congressmen who were making decisions about their life's conditions and their future for their children. So Martin Luther King came up with the idea that we would bring people from those communities throughout the nation, and particularly in the South, and put them in front of these congressional committees that were passing legislation dealing with the conditions of poverty. And the way he wanted to do that was to actually bring them to Washington, D.C., set up those hearings, and have them do it. Because he wanted them to also feel that they had the power to help change their conditions. They couldn't do it by themselves, but they should be participants in helping to bring about those changes. So he wanted to give them the opportunity to do that. Also, he wanted the nation to be able to be witness to the impoverished conditions by having the people themselves there.
So this was very controversial for Dr. King, because there were many who said, you just stick to racial discrimination. You just stick to voting rights. Don't be, you know, branching out and organizing, you know, economic justice campaigns, campaigns against the Vietnam War. And in his last year, of course, he spoke out quite powerfully against the Vietnam War. Why did he branch out?
Well, there were three reasons why Martin Luther King branched out and expanded his focus in terms of social change. One is that we often separate our issues when we are trying to bring about changes. Martin Luther King was post-Renaissance in his thinking and planning for campaigns. So at this point, he was looking at all of the factors that contributed to the conditions that exist. And he began to also do another thing, and that was the people. So it wasn't just about, in those days we call them Negroes and discrimination, but there were other people, like the Native Americans, et cetera. I remember when he was planning for the Poor People's Campaign, and I was in awe. We had just finished a staff meeting with Hosea Williams, Jim Bevel, and Jesse Jackson, Dorothy Cotton, and T.Y. Rogers, and Fred Bennett, and others. And then these were people who were head of different projects and programs. They were program directors. So my job was to supervise all these program directors. But Martin Luther King was calling this the Poor People's Campaign. So I stayed behind, and he was in the boardroom, and sitting down, and I had my pad, because I was taking copious notes on everything, because I had to try to learn what Martin Luther King was thinking about and how we were going to go about coordinating this Poor People's Campaign. So I said to him, I said, Dr. King, I just want to be clear in terms of our focus here, because when you say poor people, we're not just talking about, Negroes or black folks, you know. He said, yes, that's right. I said, what about the Chicanos and Hispanics? He said, yes, we want them involved. So we had to identify the leadership of these different kind of groups if we were going to bring them into the campaign and build a coalition. And then I said to him, well, Dr. King, what about the Native Americans? He said, yes, we want the Native Americans involved. And I said, okay, so we have to identify the people who are the leaders of the Native Americans. At this point, Martin Luther King put his hand on his chin, swiveled his chair around, and looked directly up at me, because he knew what the next question was going to be. He was so perceptive. And I said, well, what about the whites who are poor? And Martin Luther King said, are they poor? I said, yes. He said, we want them involved. Okay. Now, who was the leader of the poor white folk? I had to think about it a lot. But Miles Horton would be helpful in that area, because he worked with all people and lots of poor whites, and particularly those who were involved in labor unions. They were the working poor as well. So that would be the beginning of the leadership, bringing white people in and that kind of thing. So Martin Luther King was holistic in terms of the Poor People's Campaign. He was holistic in terms of the issues. Now, we must say, and it's a matter of history and it's factual, that some people were very much opposed to Martin Luther King taking a stand against the war in Vietnam. And that also dealt with the use of our resources, our governmental resources. But at the same time, the larger number of people who were being killed in Vietnam, the Americans who were involved in the war, were also coming from poor families. And once you got a working person killed, the family would be decimated, okay? And there would be no future for many of their fathers. You know, these people who were being killed were fathers of children, and that meant that they had to grow up without, you know, the parents or whatever in many cases. So if there was a way for us to solve these problems without having all these casualties, Martin Luther King was certainly in favor of it. In fact, he said himself, I fought against segregation too long to now segregate my conscience, and violence anywhere is a threat to violence. It's a, you know, threat to justice everywhere. And that we did not believe that we could solve our problems by using violence, but only nonviolence. And love is the thing that drives out hate. Hate does not drive out hate. And violence does not drive out violence, only peaceful ways. And he was calling upon our country to take another look at this. Now, some people on a practical level were concerned that if Martin Luther King turned from civil rights to peace, they were going to lose a lot of support for their civil rights groups, because whites then were going to start giving their money to peace movements rather than civil rights. But Martin Luther King did not separate the two. That civil rights, human rights, and the rights of all people, and violence was a way of violating the rights of people, not securing the rights of people. And so Martin Luther King put it all together. Now, I didn't realize that he was observing me, like before I joined the staff, but this is something that's little known. It's not publicized a lot. But one of the important things that happened in Martin Luther King's life, in addition to speaking at Riverside Church on April 4th in 1967, he also spoke at the UN in April 15th, 1967, in New York. And that was after a march from Central Park, because I was the national coordinator of the spring mobilization to end the war in Vietnam. And by the time we organized all the people from Central Park to the UN, the rally was over, because there were so many people. We put 1 million people in the streets between New York and California. Mrs. King, Coretta Scott King, spoke in California. But that was one of the things that caused Nixon to reconsider the budget.
We're speaking on the Vermont Conversation with Dr. Bernard Lafayette, one of the giants of the civil rights movement. He was the national coordinator of the 1968 Poor People's Campaign. Dr. Lafayette, you were with Martin Luther King on the day that he was assassinated. Talk about what he was doing in Memphis. It was part of the Poor People's Campaign.
Yes, Memphis was a significant part of the Poor People's Campaign, but Martin Luther King had not planned to go to Memphis. We were in Atlanta having our staff meeting, planning for the Poor People's Campaign, and he got this phone call from Memphis. And they were saying that the sanitation workers were on strike and they needed Martin Luther King's support to give them sort of a shot in the arm, so to speak, because they had been boycotting and they were on strike so long and walking and not getting any kind of support, until these sanitation workers' strike needed a boost in the arm, so to speak. And they just wanted Martin Luther King to come up for one day and make a speech, march with them, give them some more, you know, verb and give them some determination. And then he was going to return back to Atlanta. And so he told us to stay there and continue to our meeting. But when the march with the sanitation workers broke out in violence once they got downtown, then all of us went up to Memphis, the entire program staff, and we were going to do the march over again. So actually that night before, April 3rd, Martin Luther King and I were working on a press statement, because he was actually scheduled to be in Washington, D.C., later on to do a press conference on the Poor People's Campaign, opening up our national headquarters, 14th and U. And he couldn't go, so he was going to send me. He was sending me to go. So I was working on a press statement that night, and Martin Luther King was already in bed in his pajamas. And I was sitting there in a chair, and we were tweaking the press statement. And Martin Luther King got a phone call. And the phone call was from Abernathy, who was at the Mason Temple Church.
This is Church Reverend of God. Ralph Abernathy.
Yeah, Ralph David Abernathy, who was the, at this point, Abernathy had been appointed, in addition to being the treasurer of the organization, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was appointed by Martin Luther King in the reconstruction of the staff and the organization as the vice president at large. He had vice presidents and that kind of thing, but he made Abernathy the vice president at large, which was indicative of the fact that he wanted Abernathy to replace him if something happened. So Abernathy was calling and asking Martin Luther King to come. Martin Luther King's response was, and I was there in the Lorraine Hotel in 306, and Dr. King said, "Are you telling me that I need to get out of my bed, take off my pajamas and get dressed, and come out in the pouring down rain?" He said, "And it's raining cats and dogs." That was an expression they used in the South. And he said, the answer was, "Yes, this is your crowd." In other words, when the other people went there, like Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young, and Jim Bevel, and all of them, Jose Williams. The crowd got very excited at the church, but when they found that Martin Luther King was not there, they went so disappointed, and they didn't want to hear anybody else but Martin Luther King. So Martin Luther King told me to stay there at the hotel and work on the statement, and he'd go. So he did, and that's how he made that speech. People were standing outside in the rain. He had no preparation for it because he didn't plan to go.
And this speech was?
Mountaintop.
The Mountaintop. Just remind people what he said in that speech.
Well, this was his last public speech, and the thing that we remember most of all is Martin Luther King said this. He said, I've been to the mountaintop, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I believe we as a people will get to the promised land. Martin Luther King was getting something like about 11 death threats a day. Those are the ones we knew about. We don't know how many others, but he was operating in a way that every moment of his life counted. And he did not know how long he would, be with us. Now, that morning of April 4th, we resumed the work on the press statement because he was so enthusiastic and excited when the mass meeting was over. He was not in the mood to work on a press statement. He was just euphoric. He and Andrew Young had a pillow fight. So he could be in playful moods as well. So that morning, I was sitting with him finishing up, and the last things he said to me was that, you go ahead and have the press conference, and I'll be along later. And then he said, now, Lafayette, and he called me Lafayette because there was another person on the staff named Bernard Lee, so they wouldn't get mixed up. He always called me Lafayette. He said, Lafayette, the next thing we're going to do is to internationalize and institutionalize nonviolence. Institutionalize nonviolence, internationalize. Okay, comma, for further discussion. And so I left and went on to Washington, and he told me to go ahead and he'd be along later. When I arrived in D.C., this was called the National Airport then, no ride was there for me. And Walter Fauntroy was scheduled to pick me up. And I called the office and found out that Walter Fauntroy and Stokely Carmichael were out there in the streets trying to stop a riot because Martin Luther King had been shot. Oh, well. So I was still at the airport, so I went and grabbed a telephone and I couldn't get through to Memphis, so I called UPI, United Press International, and I called AP, Associated Press. I had two telephones there around the circular booth, and I had one phone in one ear and one phone in the other ear, and they were reading to me the ticker tape coming from the news from Memphis. And I knew that Martin Luther King had been shot, but I didn't think he was going to die because he'd also been stabbed while he was doing book signings in New York much earlier. And in fact, Martin Luther King had a perfect cross over his heart as a result of the scars from that stabbing. He had a cross over his heart. And I did not believe he was going to die. I resisted thinking about it. But when this white reporter from UPI broke down in tears on the phone as he was reading the ticker tape, he stopped. and I could hear him sniffling and crying. That was how I knew that Martin Luther King had died. I have never cried. I didn't have time, and I don't have time, because I made up in my mind that I was not going to let Martin Luther King's work or his dream, okay, die. So I made up my mind that I would go ahead. We did the funeral. We had to go back and do the sanitation workers' strike. And then we had to do the Poor People's Campaign without Martin Luther King. So we had to pick up on what we had learned from Martin Luther King and his ideas and what he had said to us, etc., and how he wanted to do it, and then put that into action. And we worked and made sure that that campaign went forward. But then I personally decided that I was going to take up the work in building institutions of nonviolence and internationalizing them. And that's what I've been doing for the last 50 years all over the world. I was involved in Mandela's campaign. I was involved in Colombia. I was kidnapped by the FARC. Okay. Even in Selma, Alabama, I didn't finish that. But the night that Medgar Evers was assassinated in Mississippi, the FBI told me that was the same night that they had, were going to kill me, because there was a plan in New Orleans for a tri-state conspiracy. They were going to kill Ben Elton Cox, who was on the Freedom Rides in Louisiana, Medgar in Mississippi, and they were going to kill me. So they were trying to lure me off into a place where they were going to, a crowd was waiting for me in Selma, Alabama. But I survived, so I wanted to make sure that Martin Luther King's work survived. And that's why I made sure that SCLC, the organization, still is in existence. And that's why we have our building there. And we have Charles Steele Jr. is our president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Now, the Poor People's Campaign has now been revived. Reverend William Barber of North Carolina has been its most visible leader. But all across the country, and we've seen it even here in Vermont, there have been protests. I know that Ben and Jerry's been involved in supporting the modern Poor People's Campaign. What advice do you, a leader of the original Poor People's Campaign, have for today's Poor People Campaign about how to be effective and take on issues of economic justice?
That is the most crucial thing that must happen now, is the economic justice, because people can't really be free until they also have economic wherewithal. And that's the important thing about the Poor People's Campaign, is that it must have within it some means for people to be able to be self-sufficient and not simply have us as people who will be charitable. The most charitable thing we can do is give people the wherewithal and the strength to be independent economically, so they too can participate and happen to share with others. So the modern Poor People's Campaign that we see now, led by Reverend Barber, we encourage that and we support that. However, one of the things that we must consider in order to bring about change is the way Martin Luther King did it. And in addition to the protests, which helps to make poverty visible and to prick the conscience of people, we must come up with a very specific plan of how we make change. And that's why the training, the nonviolence training, is so important, because it helps people to see the full process. And that's why Martin Luther King, in 12 years, and that's all he was with us as it was in the movement since 55 until his death, only 12 years he was able to bring about some significant changes in our legislation and programs related to helping to eliminate poverty and discrimination.
Okay, well, Dr. Bernard Lafayette, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thank you, and thanks to Ben and Jerry. I have really been extremely impressed here in Vermont with the kind of climate and atmosphere. And actually, it's not just the company itself, but Ben and Jerry has really influenced the community. Vermont is not an ordinary place.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. And you can hear this in all Vermont Conversations at vermontconversation.com. And you can see the exhibit about the Poor People's Campaign at the Ben & Jerry's factory in Waterbury all year. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening.